Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. An interim nuclear agreement between Iran and six major powers will be extended through Friday to provide more time for talks on a final agreement, the United States said Tuesday. We have made substantial progress in every area, but this work is highly technical and high stakes for all of the countries involved, said U.S. delegation spokeswoman Marie Harf. We are frankly more concerned about the quality of the deal than we are about the clock, Harf's statement said. EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini said earlier Tuesday, quote, "We are interpreting in a flexible way our deadline, which means that we are taking the time, the days we still need, to finalize the agreement." Pressure is mounting for Greece to deliver a credible financial plan as leaders of the 19-member Euro currency union meet in Brussels. The stakes are high as an escalating crisis over Greece's bailout threatens the country's financial stability and its Eurozone membership. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Eurogroup Chief Jeroen Dijsselbloem echoed the message being sounded by other members of the currency union as he started a day of crisis talks in Brussels.
After the no vote in Greece, we need to hear from the Greek government first how they see a way out, how they think we can come to an agreement.
Experts warn it may not be easy or quick to find common ground between Greece and its Eurozone counterparts after Greek voters overwhelmingly rejected their bailout offer on Sunday. The group's finance ministers met Tuesday before a summit in Brussels. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras is expected to present new proposals during those talks. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And you are listening to the news coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama's top military officials go before lawmakers Tuesday to discuss the strategy for fighting the Islamic State group, a day after Mr. Obama said that effort would be long, hard-fought, and require more than American military might to win. Defense Secretary Ash Carter and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Martin Dempsey will testify before the Senate Armed Services Committee. They appeared at a similar hearing of the House Armed Services Committee last month, where Carter said Iraq had not brought in enough military recruits to train against the militants. Mr. Obama met with Secretary Carter and top military commanders and intelligence officials Monday at the Pentagon, where he pledged to defeat the Islamic State group without dragging America into another ground war. Monday's meeting followed a weekend of intensified airstrikes by a U.S.-led coalition against the militants, who have taken control of large swaths of northern and western Iraq and eastern Syria. Gunmen stormed a residential compound in northeastern Kenya on Tuesday and killed 14 people. Al-Shabaab militants have claimed responsibility for the shootings in Sogo Mbuzi, a village located near Kenya's border with Somalia. A Kenyan senator told VOA the attack targeted two houses occupied by non-Somali Kenyans who work in construction and other businesses. U.S. President Barack Obama hosts Vietnam's Communist Party leader Tuesday at the White House, the latest effort to strengthen ties between the two former foes. General Secretary Nguyen Phu Trong's visit, the first ever by a Vietnamese communist leader, comes shortly after the 40th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. The two countries normalized relations 20 years ago and have been moving closer together as regional tensions involving China increase around the South China Sea. A White House statement said Mr. Obama looks forward to discussing ways to strengthen bilateral ties. Britain is marking the 10th anniversary of the deadly Islamist suicide attacks on London's public transport system. 52 people were killed on July 7, 2005, when four young British men set off bombs in three subway trains and a bus during the morning commute. Prime Minister David Cameron bowed silently Tuesday before laying a wreath in Hyde Park, where a memorial had been set up to honor the victims. Pope Francis will spend the second day of his three-nation South American tour holding an open-air mass in Ecuador's capital of Quito Tuesday. Hundreds of thousands of the faithful are expected to gather in Quito's Bicentennial Park to hear the pontiff on his last day in Ecuador. The 78-year-old Francis spent Monday holding an open-air service where he offered both prayers and praise for the institution of families. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhiben coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Kenyan officials say 14 people were killed in an attack by Al-Shabaab militants early Tuesday in Mandera County, close to the border with Somalia. Officials credit the swift response of security forces with preventing a greater tragedy.
That's VOA correspondent Gabe Justo reporting. Details coming up.
Also in the news, as many as 25 Nigerian civil servants have died when a bomb exploded this morning in a primary school in Kaduna State. And Amnesty International says migrants, asylum seekers, and refugees fleeing conflict and violence often face abuse and extortion in Europe.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Kenyan officials say 14 people were killed in an attack by Al-Shabaab militants early today in Mandera County, close to the border with Somalia. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports that officials credit the swift response of security forces with preventing a greater tragedy.
Kenya Interior Secretary Joseph Nkaiserry said the attack began after midnight when a group of Al-Shabaab assailants raided a residential estate in Mandera town, setting off a bomb at the gate to gain entry.
Immediately after the IED's explosion, police on patrol swung into action and engaged the attackers who had gained access into the estate and started shooting residents at random.
14 people were killed in the attack. A local senator told VOA's Somali service up to 20 militants may have been involved. And Nkaiserry said the militants planned to lay siege to the entire compound, putting some 150 residents in danger. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack, which took place in the same area where militants killed 36 sleeping quarry workers in December.
Once again, this attack is a clear reminder that Al-Shabaab and its collaborators are determined to disrupt and subvert our way of life. I take this opportunity to reiterate that Kenya shall never be cowed by these evil murderers.
The Somalia-based militant group has launched several large-scale assaults in Kenya in retaliation for Kenya's military involvement in Somalia. In the largest assault, militants killed 148 people at Garissa University College in April. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
As many as 25 Nigerian civil servants have died when a bomb exploded this morning in a primary school in Kaduna State. Another 32 were injured, and authorities expect the death toll to rise. At the time of the blast, teachers and government workers in the city of Zaria were at the school for identity checks. Kaduna State Governor Nasir El Rufia tweeted a warning that Nigerians should avoid crowds in churches and mosques as the one-week death toll from the terrorist bombings reaches 200. Zaria is also the home of Ahmadu Bello University, the second largest university in Africa. Meanwhile, in Nigeria's second largest city, Kano, a teenage suicide bomber blew herself up yesterday as she approached the Umar Ibn al-Khattab Mosque. She was the only casualty. Boko Haram has not claimed credit for either bombings, but authorities often blame the Islamist insurgents. In related news, Nigerian authorities have released 180 people who were arrested for alleged links to Islamist extremist group Boko Haram. Chris Stein has more on the story with reporting by Karim Haruna in Maiduguri, Nigeria.
The release of the captives comes a month after a report by Amnesty International alleging severe detainee abuse by the Nigerian military. Some of the 180 men, women, and children who were released Monday by the military in the Borno state capital of Maiduguri told VOA they suffered no ill treatment during their detention. Usman Lawan, a farmer from the town of Konduga, says he was arrested on suspicion of belonging to the sect and held for 2 months. He says he wants to go home.
If there is way, I will back there again. If there is no way, then I will see for government care again.
The move was welcomed by Amnesty International, whose report documented torture and extrajudicial murders by the military at detention centers in the Northeast. The military called the report blackmail, but Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari promised to investigate its claims. Amnesty Africa Director for Research and Advocacy, Netsanit Bale, said those released need to be properly compensated.
Our research suggests that there were deplorable detention conditions, and these have been victims of that detention. And so there is a critical need for the government to ensure that there is adequate compensation and reparations program initiated with immediate effect to support these victims.
Borno State Governor Kashim Shettima said the state would allow the former detainees to go back to school and give them training so they can find work. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
The Associated Press says get tough measures promised last week by President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi are being fast-tracked through his cabinet. The controversial anti-terrorism bill was leaked to Egyptian media yesterday, revealing measures designed to deliver swift justice against terrorist acts. The draft bill creates special terrorism courts and shortens the appeals process. It also increases police powers to arrest journalists who publish reporting on attacks that is contrary to information released by the government. Local media call the media measure a disaster. The cabinet approved the bill last Wednesday, 2 days after a car bomb killed top public prosecutor Hisham Barakat, and Islamic militants launched multiple suicide attacks against military checkpoints in the Sinai Peninsula. Sinai violence increased after the government ousted President Mohamed Morsi and banned the Muslim Brotherhood. Last week, the State Council added an amendment to the controversial bill. The addition authorizes a jail sentence for anyone who records or broadcasts proceedings in a terrorism case without court permission. Egypt has been without a parliament for 2 years. The bill only requires the approval of the president and his cabinet to become law.
Amnesty International says migrants, asylum seekers, and refugees fleeing conflict and violence often face abuse and extortion in Europe. The rights group says many also find themselves in legal limbo in Macedonia, Serbia, and Hungary. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
While more than 60,000 migrants and refugees have crossed the Mediterranean from Libya to Europe, an equal number has taken a different route. They first traveled to Turkey, followed by a short boat ride to the Greek islands. From there, they try to make their way through Macedonia, Serbia, and Hungary. That's the group that Amnesty International is raising concerns about in its new report, Europe's Borderlands. Amnesty's Balkans team researcher, Sean Jones, is tracking their movements.
What we're finding is that at each of the borders, there are pushbacks. People are being pushed back from Macedonia into Greece. And there is quite a large presence at the border of Macedonian police. And we understand maybe some Macedonian military.
Refugees and migrants have been taking the Balkans route since 2014. Most are Syrians, but others are from Afghanistan, Egypt, Eritrea, Iraq, Nigeria, Somalia, Sudan, and Tunisia.
What we do is we follow the journey that people make through the region and we look at the human rights violations.
Jones says there are dangers. Nearly 30 are believed to have been struck and killed by trains in the Balkans. The refugees and migrants follow the rails to towns and cities.
They're also subject to abuses by armed gangs who rob them, steal their money, beat them up.
She says if they're arrested along with a smuggler, they're held as a witness, often in harsh conditions.
They're detained at what's called the Reception Center for Foreigners, which is a place called Gazi Baba, which has been condemned by the UN Committee Against Torture and various other human rights bodies as inhuman and degrading in terms of the conditions there.
And they can be detained indefinitely.
They are detained until such time as the smuggler is brought to court. That can be, in some cases, over 6 months. They don't have any appeal. they don't have any access to a lawyer.
She says photos of the Macedonian detention center that were smuggled out show conditions are appalling.
There can be up to 400 people there detained at any one time, and there are two working showers in the men's section. Families are separated. Children are detained, not only children in families, but also unaccompanied minors.
Amnesty reports that migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers are regularly detained in Serbia, but many reach the northern town of Subotica, about 30 kilometers from the Hungarian border. Here is where they may make arrangements with smugglers to get them across the European Union border. While waiting, most find accommodation in an old and unused brick factory known as the jungle. There, they try to hide from police. Aid agencies have been providing food, clothing, and shoes there since 2011. The rights group says some refugees and migrants told them Serbian police pushed, slapped, kicked, and beat them at the border with Hungary. The Amnesty report does not go into detail about conditions in Hungary. However, it says those who claim asylum there are detained and fingerprinted. The Hungarian parliament has passed new laws tightening its asylum rules. The laws spell out how the government can erect a fence along the Serbian border. They can also make it easier to reject asylum claims. The UN and the Council of Europe have criticized the new laws. Jones says Amnesty is calling for legal and safe routes into Europe.
I was interviewing some Syrians and they said, why can't we apply at an embassy? Why do we have to be illegal? People are being criminalized by this journey. They're being arrested for being irregularly in the country. They are given no status. They may be detained in Serbia for being illegally in the country, even if they are asylum seekers, and that's actually against the Refugee Convention. So we're looking for measures that would not criminalize them.
She says it's a European problem. She says they arrive in Greece, an EU country, which is not able to deal with them, and they make their way to Hungary, another EU state.
We're also asking the EU to make sure that they support Serbia and Macedonia in developing an effective asylum system, so people who aren't really fussed about where they claim asylum would be able to claim asylum there. But essentially, it's not really a problem that Serbia and Macedonia can resolve on their own. It really needs to be looked at in the context of the whole migration policy of the EU.
Since Serbia wants to be an EU member state, Amnesty says it could be pressured to take action on establishing effective asylum. It adds, the increasing numbers of refugees and migrants taking the Western Balkans route can, in part, be attributed to measures taken by the EU to enhance controls at other land borders. A large number of people hope to make it to Germany or Sweden, where they have family or friends. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Italy has held a funeral service today for the first 13 bodies of migrants recovered from the major Mediterranean Sea disaster last April. They are the first of as many as 800 corpses the Italian Navy is attempting to recover from 370 feet of water where their trawler sank. Many of the victims were trapped inside the boat when it collided with another vessel. The first drowning victims were recovered a few days ago. They were carried in simple wooden coffins to an interreligious ceremony at the Palazzo della Cultura in Catania, a city in eastern Sicily. Meanwhile, Greek naval vessels are searching for dozens of migrants who disappeared in the Aegean when a smuggler's boat sank near the Turkish coast. A Greek helicopter rescued six and the Turkish Coast Guard rescued about 20. Survivors say an estimated 35 may still be missing. In Belgium, a European Union prosecutor says Islamic State terrorist may be hiding among migrants being smuggled into Europe. The prosecutor says she has received reports that terrorists are infiltrating the flood of migrants entering Europe. She also said groups like the Islamic State are using proceeds from people trafficking to fund terrorism.
The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 2 1/4 million South Sudanese have become displaced since fighting between government and rebel forces erupted in December 2013. It says the number of internally displaced and refugees is growing as fighting continues. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
As South Sudan marks its fourth anniversary of independence, people are being forced every day to flee their homes because of this young country's raging civil war. The United Nations reports 1.5 million people are internally displaced, and more than 730,000 people have sought refuge in four neighboring countries. Meanwhile, nearly 250,000 Sudanese refugees have fled into South Sudan to escape fighting in the Blue Nile and South Kordofan states. UN refugee spokesman Adrian Edwards says no political end to this conflict is in sight.
Recent weeks have seen an escalation of violence in Unity and Upper Nile. Heavy fighting has forced tens of thousands of people to flee to the bush and swamplands, to areas that are often difficult to reach. This and a volatile and insecure situation is making humanitarian access extremely difficult. Ongoing hostilities and reported increase in human rights violations and abuses have contributed to additional displacement.
The UNHCR reports 180 South Sudanese refugees arrive in Ethiopia every day, and the country is already hosting about 425,000 refugees. Hundreds of thousands of others have sought refuge in Sudan, Uganda, and Kenya. In the meantime, cholera, which broke out last month in the capital Juba, has spread to the city of Bor. The UN Children's Fund reports more than 700 cholera cases have claimed 32 lives. UNICEF spokesman Christoph Bouyarak says 1 in 5 of these deaths is children under age 5.
If the current outbreak spreads beyond current locations, especially into the states affected by conflict, the lack of functioning health facilities could lead to a devastating loss of life. Currently, 184 health facilities have been closed or destroyed in conflict-affected areas.
Bouyarak says aid agencies are racing against time to prevent the spread of cholera up the Nile River in South Sudan, especially during the rainy season. He says UNICEF's priority is to reach vulnerable children with urgently needed clean water and vaccinations against this deadly disease. He says more than 100,000 people, many of them children, have received oral cholera vaccines in civilian sites in Juba and Bentiu. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up on 23 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. While pressure is mounting for Greece to deliver a credible financial plan as leaders of the 19-member Euro currency union meet in Brussels. The stakes are high as an escalating crisis over Greece's bailout threatens the country's financial stability and its Eurozone membership. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Eurogroup chief Jeroen Dijsselbloem echoed the message being sounded by other members of the currency union as he started a day of crisis talks in Brussels.
After the no vote in Greece, we need to hear from the Greek government first how they see a way out, how they think we can come to an agreement.
Experts warn it may not be easy or quick to find common ground between Greece and its Eurozone counterparts after Greek voters overwhelmingly rejected their bailout offer on Sunday. The group's finance ministers met Tuesday before a summit in Brussels. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras is expected to present new proposals during those talks. After defaulting on a debt payment to the IMF last week, Athens faces another key deadline, a $3.8 billion payment due July 20th to the European Central Bank. Missing that will escalate an already serious funding crisis in Greece. Earlier in the day, French Prime Minister Manuel Valls said it is essential that an agreement is found with Athens.
La France est convaincue que nous ne pouvons pas prendre le risque qu'une sortie.
He said France is convinced that it cannot take the risk of a Greek exit from the Eurozone for both economic but especially political reasons. He said it represents a risk to growth and to the world economy. The United States, China, and Japan have also urged a solution that will allow Greece to remain in the currency union. But Eurozone members are divided over just how far they're willing to compromise to reach a deal. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Uber has asked police in Johannesburg, South Africa, to protect their drivers following reports of intimidation and harassment from local taxi drivers who feel the service is undercutting their trade. Several Uber users have reported being pressured into taking meter taxis in Johannesburg instead of the cars they had hailed via Uber's smartphone app. Gillian Parker reports.
Uber says recent intimidation prompted the company to ask police to protect its drivers and passengers from taxi drivers in Johannesburg. Verbal threats and harassment from meter taxi drivers only underlines why people are increasingly choosing safe, reliable alternatives like Uber, the company wrote in an online statement. Guesthouse manager Karen Abrahams said several men followed her as she attempted to get into her Uber car outside a train station in Johannesburg's business district.
They basically chased him away. And I said, I fight this with Uber members, not with you. You cannot get into this Uber taxi. I do see the point of view, but I also have the right to choose who I want to travel with. They need to know that it is a business that you're running.
Dozens of taxi drivers protested on Friday outside Uber's offices in Johannesburg, saying the online company is destroying local taxi businesses and demanding the same license legislation for meter taxis to be applied to Uber. The company is also embroiled in a licensing dispute in Cape Town, where traffic officials have impounded more than 200 Uber vehicles. Meter taxi drivers also launched a protest against the company in January. The quarrel is the latest in a long string of altercations between the San Francisco-based company and regulators and rivals from across the world. The company has suspended its popular Uber Pop service in France until the Constitutional Court decides on the legality of the service later this year. Uber's prices are unrealistically low, making it impossible to compete, says local taxi driver Petros Mishlongo. He says that confronting drivers is the only way to deal with the issue.
At the end of the day, when there is a problem, we need to sit down and solve the problem. So who do you sit down with? They just come and impose their own regulations. Somehow you can see there's something wrong with them. Yeah, there's a problem with them. Not that we don't like them. We like them, especially, you know, the technological part of it. We like it very well. But in terms of prices, it's bad. Now, weekends, working overnight, I would make R1,000. I can hardly make R500 a night of late.
Uber has amassed its $41 billion valuation, expanding into 57 countries in 6 years, largely due to its ability to circumvent the tightly regulated taxi industry. In South Africa, Uber users requested 2 million rides in the first half of this year, compared with 1 million in all of 2014, according to company statistics. Despite the cheap prices and seasonal deals, the service only caters for those South Africans equipped with a smartphone and credit card. The majority travel on bus taxis. South Africa's mini taxi industry, often lumbered with the reputation of reckless driving and decrepit vehicles, moves 15 million people every day, most of them lower income blacks. The industry is loosely valued at $3.7 billion. Taxi cartels, however, vie for routes, with turf wars sometimes resulting in violence. Several taxi drivers were attacked and murdered earlier this year. Uber maintains that incidents involving their cars are isolated. Nevertheless, frustration amongst Johannesburg's metered cab drivers steadily grows. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Lino Hmoudou.
Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Kenyan officials say 14 people were killed in an attack by Al-Shabaab militants early today in Mandera County. As many as 25 Nigerian civil servants have died when a bomb exploded this morning in a primary school in Kaduna State. And Amnesty International says migrants, asylum seekers, and refugees fleeing conflict and violence often face abuse and extortion in Europe. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa, and in our feature segment, researchers inch closer to the development of a treatment and cure for dengue fever. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Spuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have lots and lots of African football news for us today.
Kim, joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, the African coaching carousel continues to turn. About a half dozen changes the past couple weeks. Let's begin in Nigeria, David. Stephen Keshi gets the boot as the head coach of the Super Eagles. Your reaction?
I did sort of envisage this was going to happen, and it comes really as no surprise. This was an accident waiting to happen. Stephen Keshi applied for the Ivory Coast job very soon after he had been appointed coach of Nigeria, and that to me was just footballing suicide. And no surprises, Nigerian football authorities have basically said that they felt that his focus was not completely on the Super Eagles, the national senior team. I suppose just adding salt into those wounds of Keshi at the moment is the fact that he didn't even make the shortlist for the Ivorian position. And now he's out of a job, but probably not for too long, Sonny. He's been relatively successful, of course, the highlight being winning the 2013 Africa Cup of Nations with Nigeria. Big surprise that. Ivory Coast were the firm favourites. Nigeria knocked them out in the quarterfinals. The Nigerians then took Mali apart in the semifinals and then won a tight final against Burkina Faso 1-0. But that was certainly one of the positive ticks against the name of Stephen Keshi. But why, oh, why, oh, why he would apply for the Ivory Coast job so soon after being appointed coach of Nigeria? I don't know, Sonny. I don't have an answer to that one. Stephen Keshi is known as the big boss. You either love him or you loathe him. You admire him or you dislike his style. But the way it's going, Sonny, as you said, this carousel, I was just looking before we went on air. In the last couple of weeks alone, Mozambique have fired their coach. Malawi have fired their coach. The Namibian coach has resigned. Tanzania have fired their coach. And that we did predict on the Sunny Side of Sports, 6 defeats in a row. So that, again, was almost inevitable. Tunisia, Sunny, another one. George Leekens, the Belgian, who did very well, I felt, with the Carthage Eagles in the recent Cup of Nations. He got them to the quarterfinals where they went out after that rather controversial penalty. They gave Equatorial Guinea an equalizer, and then the Equatorial Guineans went on to win 2-1 after extra time. Now, Leekens claims that he was due a bonus from the Cup of Nations. It wasn't paid. He clearly is a man of principle. He said, give me the money or else. The Tunisians said no, and Mr. Leekens was on the plane out of the country quicker than you could say, I've resigned. And now we've got Stephen Keshi, and by my mathematics, Sonny, I was not too bad at school. That is 6 national coaches gone in just a couple of weeks. So, yeah, I think if Stephen Keshi is patient, he should get a chance again soon. Who knows where, though? And perhaps the next time, when he applies for another job while he's still in one, he must tell his prospective employees to keep it quiet, Sonny, and not put it on the internet where everybody can see it.
David, action continuing in the African Nations Championship for players based in Africa. How about an update on the recent results?
Right, Sonny, we're through now at the preliminary round of the African Nations Championship, also known as CHAN, and as you said, it's for players who are locally based. And there is one thing, Sonny, that seems to still be causing confusion, judging from emails I'm getting from Voice of America listeners. They seem to think that if you're playing anywhere in Africa, you're eligible. That is incorrect. Let's take a Nigerian as an example. If you're a Nigerian, you must be playing in Nigeria. You must be playing in the Nigerian League to be eligible. If you're a Nigerian and you're playing in South Africa or in Tunisia, you are ineligible. So let's just stress that point again. It's for home-based players only. A Nigerian must be playing in Nigeria, a Tunisian in Tunisia, a South African in South Africa. Let's look at it zone by zone, Sonny, starting with the West A zone. That's the countries in the north of West Africa. In Bamako, it was Mali 3, Guinea-Bissau 1. Mali win 4-2 in aggregate. No surprise here. But a little bit of a scare for the Malians in that they fell behind in the second leg, but they equalized before halftime, and two goals in the last 15 minutes gave them a 3-1 victory. In Bakau in Gambia, it was Gambia 0, Senegal 1 in Doi after just 7 minutes. Again, no real surprises here, but a good away win nevertheless for the Senegalese. They led 3-1 from the first leg, so they qualified 4-1 on aggregate. In Monrovia, it was Liberia 1, Guinea 1. Guinea qualified 4-2 on aggregate. Sad homecoming this Sunday for the Liberians. They've been unable to stage international football for 13 months because of the Ebola epidemic. But great news for Liberians. The country was recently declared Ebola-free, and that's a great relief for both Liberians and fellow West Africans. This Ebola epidemic has now claimed 11,200 lives, according to the World Health Organization. A truly sad tale indeed. And it was great for Liberia to be back at home in Monrovia, but unfortunately, despite a packed 10,000 crowd and a first-half goal from C from the penalty spot, they couldn't pull it off. My belief was that the Liberians' only hope of survival was to win 2-0 and scrape through on the away goal rule, but that second goal never came, and Kamara equalized for Guinea in the second half. Guineans now face Senegal, and Mali will face Mauritania. Just a reminder of a match played a week ago, the second leg in which Mauritania were at home against Sierra Leone, also because of the Ebola epidemic. The Mauritanians won 2-0, so it was 4-1 in aggregate.
David, in a result from the Southern Zone in 2016 African Nations Championship qualifying, Zimbabwe and the host Comoros Islands played to a scoreless draw. Zimbabwe advances on a 2-0 aggregate. The Warriors of Zimbabwe overcame some travel problems, as we hear now from reporter Michael Cariati in Harare.
Warriors supporters say they were surprised but happy that the squad managed to go past the Comoros, though they were stuck in Harare before traveling to Moron. Most of them say the Zimbabwe Football Association should put its act together to ensure that the Warriors do not face the same problem ahead of an encounter with Lesotho in the next round. Captain Benepiri said they hope to steamroll over Lesotho, especially in the home game, which will be crucial in deciding the outcome of the two-legged match.
We're expecting to do the same thing against Lesotho. Come here to home, get a win, go there and finish the job in Lesotho.
Former Caps United defender Charles Mandjera said it was good that the Warriors won, and this would stimulate interest from the fans who have been used to defeat.
I'm very happy because when the nation does well, it benefits everybody from the bottom, from the junior level to everything.
Turning to the Castle Lager Premier Soccer League, the Castle Lager Premier Soccer League program rolled into week 15 with Caps United, the biggest winners of the week after a 2-0 win over leaders Chicken Inn. Goals from Leonard Fiado saw the Green Machine collect maximum points and move to fifth position on the league table with 24 points. Caps United supporter Zwanaimuroiwa said it was heartening that the Green Machine are back
very happy that we collected maximum points.
The defeat, however, did not have much impact on Chicken Inn's position at the top of the table. They are a point above Triangle, who played a 1-0 draw against Highlanders at Baba Field Stadium. Now we turn to rugby. There were celebrations too in rugby after the Sables beat Tunisia 19-8 at Prince Edward School in an Africa Cup encounter. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Kariati.
Joining us now with a Tuesday Wimbledon tennis update is VOA's Jonah Haskell. Hi, Jonah.
Hey, Sonny. The quarterfinals of Wimbledon are underway in London as the field has been narrowed to just 8 players on both the men's and women's sides. Still in the running on the women's side is world number one Serena Williams, who had to beat her older sister Venus in the round of 16 to advance. Although playing Venus at Wimbledon for the 6th time, it was just the first time that the sisters had met at a major in 6 years. After the match, Serena spoke about what she needed to do to get the win.
I think I played solid. I knew that playing someone like Venus that's beaten me the most, I have to be solid. I had to cut down on unforced errors. I had to take a lot of chances, so I was able to do that.
Overall, this was the Williams sisters' 26th time facing each other in a professional match. With her victory, Serena has now won 15 of those matchups to Venus's 11. Williams will be playing Victoria Azarenka of Belarus in the quarterfinals. Meanwhile, 2 quarterfinal matches are already over. Spanish player Garbina Muguruza needed only 2 sets to send Timea Baksinski home, while unseeded American Coco Vandeweghe pushed world number 4 Maria Sharapova to the limit before the Russian closed out the match for a 6-3, 6-7, 6-2 win. Muguruza and Sharapova now move on to the semifinals, where Sharapova will face the winner of Azarenka-Williams, while Muguruza will play the victor of the quarterfinal between Agnieszka Radwanska and Madison Keys. The men's quarterfinals, which will be played on Wednesday, should be an exciting affair, as all of the top 4 seeds in the tournament are still in it. If the entire foursome of Novak Djokovic, Roger Federer, Andy Murray, and Stan Wawrinka can triumph in their respective quarterfinal matches, then it will be the first time that all 4 top seeds reach the semifinal of a major tournament since the 2012 Australian Open. Djokovic, the number 1 seed this year, almost didn't make it past his round of 16 match on Monday. Taking on Kevin Anderson of South Africa, Djokovic lost the first 2 sets and looked like he might be headed home when he stormed back to win the next 2. The match eventually had to be cut short due to darkness, but resumed Tuesday morning for the decisive 5th set. Anderson, the only African at Wimbledon, matched the Joker game for game before he finally faltered. With a final score of 6-7, 6-7, 6-1, 6-4, 7-5, Djokovic advances to face Marin Cilic in the semifinal on Wednesday. And with your Tuesday Wimbledon update, I'm Jonah Haskell. Back to you, Sonny.
Thank you, Jonah. And I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and thank you, Jonah and Toddy. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, researchers inching closer to development of a treatment and cure for dengue fever. And next, training health workers in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. But first, some music. It is Shaka Bundu of South Africa with Penny Penny.
Aye.
Kabundu of South Africa with Penny Penny.
Well, researchers are inching closer to development of a treatment and cure for dengue fever caused by a mosquito-borne virus in the tropics that infects millions of people every year. Investigators have found a protein, a monoclonal antibody, that zaps one of four types of dengue. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
There are four so-called serotypes of dengue fever, which infects an estimated 400 million people each year. The disease causes severe flu-like symptoms. In severe cases caused by repeated infection, the disease can be fatal. In a study published in the journal Science, researchers in the U.S. and Singapore described the discovery of a potent human antibody that neutralizes dengue type 2, an aggressive version of the virus. The monoclonal antibody was discovered in the blood of patients stricken with dengue. James Crowe is director of the Vaccine Center at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Tennessee. Crowe, a study co-author, says the monoclonal antibody stops infection in humans at the cellular level.
The virus injects its own genes into the cell to make more of itself, and this antibody actually staples the virus closed so that it can't do that injecting of its own genes into cells.
In experiments with mice, the human monoclonal antibody easily killed dengue serotype 2. Crowe believes the discovery will lead to a drug to treat all four types of dengue fever.
We believe that it's possible to find similar antibodies for the other serotypes. So if we actually move forward for developing a therapeutic for humans, this will probably be a mixture or cocktail of four antibodies, and this would be one of the antibodies, which corresponds to one of the four viruses.
Crowe says researchers are in talks with a number of drug companies interested in using the discovery to develop a cure for dengue fever. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
When the Ebola virus hit West Africa, the corps of healthcare workers collapsed. The World Health Organization says Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea needed to more than double their numbers now to reach international health development targets. Who will train them? Vince McCorry spoke with Maria Tukagbo, president and founder of Global Health College in Alexandria, Virginia. He asked her what led her to training health workers.
I believe that what I do is a calling. You know, many years ago, my parents had encouraged me to take their paths, you know, one in business and one in nursing. And so I decided to satisfy both of their requirement. And so with the passion to follow the footsteps of my parents and the passion to educate others, I've been referred to as an educational student, professional student. Yes. So I decided that opening a college to offer the privilege of lifelong learning to so many people was imperative.
You are a native of Sierra Leone, one of those countries that were seriously affected by the Ebola epidemic. How did your observation of how things were happening and the need for health workers influence or at least make you think about what you're doing in training health workers?
Yes, absolutely. From watching from outside, it appears it was a lack of either education in the sense that the healthcare practitioners did not know how to prevent the spread of the disease. But most importantly, the citizens in the country were not informed of the detrimental effect of the disease.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about what kind of training you're providing in your college right in the United States.
Okay. Very several different programs, starting from a one-month program to nurse aide, you know, nursing assistant, to practical nurses and the associate degree level and the bachelor's level in nursing.
When we think about health, the health sector, mm-hmm. we think of doctors right up there. Every young kid wants to be a doctor. Tell us the value, the role of a healthcare worker below a doctor.
Absolutely. I say to my students all the time that it is important to understand your role that you play in your patient's life. Ask the nurse. You are with the client 24 hours. The physician comes in about 10, 20 minutes and they leave. So absolutely the nurses are, I believe, are the heroes of the healthcare professional.
Mm-hmm. They do quite a lot.
Absolutely.
Now somebody might say, well, Mariachi is in North Northern Virginia, or rather in America, in Virginia. What is the relevance, for instance, with people in Africa? What does your training do to help those who are in Africa?
It's amazing. Many of our students have migrated from Africa, and so the goal is for them to become educated and gain experience and return to their individual homes. Mm-hmm. So yes, educating nurses and myself, my plan is to travel to Africa and offer some of the services that I've gained over the years.
Yes, mm-hmm. And you have an opportunity to train people not only from Sierra Leone,
but nationwide. It's Global Health College.
Yes. Global Health College. And they can not work here, but also take some of the skills back home. What's your vision in very few seconds?
I want to give to people the opportunity to be self-reliant. And I believe the most powerful tool for anyone to remain, reliant on their own self is to be educated.
That was Maria Tukagbo of Global Health College in Alexandria, Virginia. She was speaking to reporter Vincent McCory. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Each year, the U.S. State Department sends Congress reports prepared by our diplomats assessing respect for human rights around the world. They evaluate how governments show respect for human dignity and individual freedoms, and they help shape our nation's foreign policies. The reports also signal to human rights defenders and activists under siege that we recognize their struggle and stand with them. For far too many people, 2014 was defined by suffering and abuse perpetrated by terrorist groups like ISIL, Boko Haram, and Al-Shabaab that exploit religious discourse and divisions to advance their destructive ideologies. Meanwhile, governments in China, Egypt, Eritrea, Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere continue to stifle a free press and the development of civil society by jailing journalists, bloggers, and others. As in previous years, the state of human rights in Somalia remains a particular U.S. concern. Civilians there continue to suffer from conflict-related abuses, including killings and the diversion or confiscation of humanitarian assistance by armed groups, particularly Al-Shabaab. According to the UN, 1,133,000 Somalis have been displaced internally, and more than 1 million others have fled to other nations. Clan militias and Al-Shabaab continue to commit grave abuses throughout the country, including extrajudicial killings, disappearances, cruel and unusual punishment, rape, restrictions on civil liberties and freedom of movement, and conscription and use of child soldiers. Some African Union peacekeeping troops also were found to have committed sexual abuse and exploitation, including rape. Violence and discrimination against women and girls, including rape and female genital mutilation or cutting, was widespread. Other major abuses included harsh and life-threatening prison conditions, arbitrary and politically motivated arrest and detention, trafficking in persons, abuse of and discrimination against minority clans, restrictions on worker rights, forced labor, and child labor. There is no self-importance or arrogance in preparing this and other reports. We in the United States have seen our own share of racial discord and unrest recently, so we approach this with great self-awareness. But we also understand that with regard for human rights, every country, including our own, has room to improve. We're committed to advancing universal rights, building partnerships that will move us forward, helping every man, woman, and child live up to their potential. And in cases like Somalia, we are also committed to speaking out for those unable to do so for themselves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. The political crisis in South Sudan is taking a heavy toll on the nation's citizens. Nearly 2 million people have been displaced due to the fighting between supporters of President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar. Tune in on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.